From PRI, Public Radio International.
Well, back at our school, pretty girls wouldn't talk to us. We were unexceptional. Failures at sports, and our fathers didn't manage banks or practice orthopedic medicine. And out on the rural highway, we dated the most beautiful of the Amish girls. They were attracted to our foreignness, and we to theirs.
You're listening to Chris Lewin reading from Andrew Porter's story, Departure, which we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Surprising Discoveries is the title we gave to this program of stories, in each of which the central characters do experience some amazing revelations. The first to be heard is Karen Russell's Disco Papa, and the discovery is what a granddaughter learns about her dancing grandpa. The reader is the California-based actress Susanna Thompson.
Don't fall, Papa, we called behind us. My brother and my sister and I were smuggling our 85-year-old grandfather across the deck of a cruise ship at his request toward the faint port pulse of the Savoy nightclub. During the day, this deck was covered with semi-nude Midwesterners, but now the landscape was lunar, as empty as the future. The railings were slippery and cold, and we kept checking to make sure that Papa, who had started coughing, was still with us. This was a bad idea, we all agreed. About an hour before, our mother instructed her father to stop knocking back $14 cocktails named for bad weather. We were supposed to escort him to bed. He was bunking with us in the de facto kids' cabin. My siblings and I are actually all surly people in our mid-20s. Now I worried that our mother would discover our empty beds and think somehow everybody fell through the porthole. Our entire family came on this cruise of the ancient world last May to celebrate our grandfather's 85th birthday, implicitly to mark the beginning of the end of his life. The trip put a frenzy into us to document everything, to keep repeating how lucky we were to be on this boat together, as if Hooded Death were watching us from the lifeguard chair. Earlier that day, we debarked to visit the ruins of Ephesus, Turkey. Picture time, mothers cried, and their kids would groan and obligingly freeze their smiles in front of some God's sandal. Papa sat on a rock and drank a $3 bottle of water. When I sat down next to him, he said he wasn't all that interested in taking pictures anymore. But he was intrigued by the world we just entered. The cheesy milieu inside the Savoy nightclub. A few honeymooners paused to stare at us. I think we had a miscellaneous air. My sister and I were freakishly sunburned on our feet and hands. My brother had a chlorinated afro, and Papa wore a light red shirt, his color wheel does not include pink, and the scowl of Samuel Beckett. The dance floor was shaped like a tortilla chip and kept lighting up in demonic colors. Two leggy blonde Swedes were shimmying near the DJ booth. We recognized them. During the day, these same ladies squirted hand sanitizer onto our palms outside the buffet. Now they smiled widely at us as if to say, "Can you believe we get paid to do this? We love the nightlife at sea." Everybody on the dance floor was either bumping or thrusting. "That's dancing now?" Papa asked. He drank two more Canadian Club cocktails and listened to Snoop Dogg and Devo. "I hate this music," he said finally. "Let's dance." And this is how I found myself at 2:15 in the morning, somewhere in the Aegean, slow dancing with my grandfather to a reggae song whose title seemed to be Prepared for Sex. Sex is imminent, the singer yells into a megaphone, and we'd better be prepared. Mercifully, my grandfather is hard of hearing. He twirled me and tried to get me to dip. I think the honeymooners believed I was his escort. But I was feeling warm with self-congratulation. I thought, I am a saint. I am dancing with my papa to prepare for sex, even though this is not perfectly comfortable, even though everybody in this disco now thinks I'm some kind of sea prostitute, because I know he will cherish this memory forever. And that's when Papa began, in a deliberate, unapologetic way, to turn counterclockwise and start dancing with both those blondes at once. Papa had ditched me, very publicly. Papa was spinning the Swedes around like tops. From the mezzanine, I watched this with astonishment. He had become a stranger. He danced like a man who had forgotten himself, his age, and his relationship to us. It was as if he existed inside one song and then the next. What I saw was not my elderly grandfather reliving his youth, but a young man, Alexei Romanchuk, who I never met. Papa has huge spatulate hands with tiny leopard sunspots. For decades, he worked as an airplane mechanic, and before that, he was a lieutenant in the Second World War. Most of that experience we've only guessed from his rogue sadnesses and omissions. But that night, still panting from the dance floor, he told us stories that we'd never heard, fixing certain words, your grandmother, the bad winter, the war, for us over an unreckonable space. Outside the huge windows, the sea looked infinite. Some stupid song was playing with lyrics I knew by heart. Papa's face was caught in a scintillating net, the lights fine as silk across his wrinkles, and it felt so strange to be with this man. Staring into his blue eyes, I was a little afraid of him. That night, I was a little afraid of everyone. There, fathoms. I don't know you, Alex, I thought. And the songs kept changing, and we were all drunk and smiling at one another, my family, as we slid over the roof of the ocean.
Disco Papa by Karen Russell, read by Susanna Thompson. In our next story, Andrew Porter's Departure, local teens in a Pennsylvania town clash with the Amish subculture, but the narrator and his buddy are surprised by the close relationships they form with some Amish girls, and which they remember years later. Parents listening should be warned that there is considerable violence in this story, so some parental guidance would be advisable. The reader is the off-Broadway actor Chris Lewin, making his Selected Shorts debut. Andrew Porter's Departure.
That spring we were 16, Tanner and I started dating the Amish girls out on the rural highway. Sometimes two or three at the same time, because it was not really dating. There was no way of getting serious. This was in 1992, over 10 years ago. And things had not yet begun to change in our part of Pennsylvania. I think of that year as a significant one now, a turning point in our county. The first year the town of Leola started growing and becoming a city, and also the first year the Amish started leaving, selling their property and heading west toward Indiana and Iowa. There'd been several cases of runaways among the Amish that year, mostly young men, barely in their 20s, tempted by the shopping malls and bars popping up along the highways near their farms. Leola was expanding quickly then. It was becoming more common, and it worried the elders in the Amish community. And I think it explains why, that spring, Some of the Amish teenagers were given permission to leave their farms for a few hours on Friday evenings. Out on the other side of town, there was an intersection on the rural highway where they would go to hang out. It was a remote area. A strip mall with a Kmart sat on one side of the intersection, and across the road there was a 24-hour diner. You would sometimes see them on Friday evenings, traveling in a long line like a funeral procession, their buggies hugging the shoulder of the road as tractor trailers rubbered by. They would park out of sight behind the Kmart, tie their horses to lampposts or the sides of dumpsters, and then the younger ones would go into the Kmart to play video games, and the older and more adventurous would cross the street to the diner. The diner was a family-style place, frequented only by local farming families and truckers, and it was usually empty. Inside, the Amish kids would disappear immediately into the bathrooms and change into blue jeans and T-shirts that they had bought at Kmart, clothes which never seemed to fit their bodies right. They would come out, their black wool clothes stuffed into paper bags, and order large platters of fried food and play country songs on the jukeboxes and try to pretend they weren't Amish. That spring, Tanner and I had begun stopping by just to see them. We never bothered them, just watched. And it never occurred to us that there might be something unnatural about what we were doing, or even wrong. We were simply curious. We wanted to know if the rumors we had heard in school were true, that there were spectacular deformities to be found among the Amish, that few of the children possessed the correct number of fingers, the results of extensive inbreeding. We would sit in a booth at the far end of the diner and glance at them from behind our menus. We were amazed to hear them curse and see them smoke cigarettes. Some of them even held hands and kissed. Sometimes other people, people from town, like us, would stop by just to watch. And you could tell that it worried them. People were still scared of the Amish then. They were still a mystery and a threat because of their wealth and the tremendous amount of land they owned. And so naturally they were disliked, treated as outsiders and freaks. At 11 o'clock, they'd change back into their clothes and, very politely, pay their checks. Then they'd cross the street in a big group, climb back into their buggies, and leave. And Tanner and I would stand out in the diner parking lot and watch them, still not believing what we had seen, but also, somehow, sad to see them go. Once the other kids at school found out about the diner, they started coming regularly in their Jeeps and BMWs, not to watch like Tanner and I, but to mock and torment. It was cruel, and it saddened us to see, though we never once tried to stop it. Instead, we sat back in the corner and watched, angry, but also privately relieved that for once it was not us who were being teased or beat up. In the midst of targets so uncool and vulnerable as Amish teenagers, the popular kids seemed to have practically forgotten us. There was one Amish kid who looked older than the rest. He could have been in his 20s. Tanner and I had noticed him the very first night because of his size and because of his face, which always looked angry. He came every week with the rest of them, but always sat off by himself in a separate booth, smoking cigarettes and punching heavy metal songs into the jukebox at his table. His anger scared us more than the others, that and his size. He had the body of a full-grown man, a laborer, his shoulders broad, forearms solid and bulging out near his elbows. When the fight started, he was always involved. They usually happened out by the dumpsters in back of the diner. The odds were never even. Always 5 or 6 against one. Having been raised strict pacifists, almost none of the Amish would fight. But he would. And despite his size, he would, of course, always lose, though he'd last longer than anyone would believe, moving with the grace of a young boxer, gliding, ducking. His style was to stay low and bring his punches up from way down under. He was quick, had a powerful jab, and knew how to protect himself. But the beauty of his moves never lasted long. Inevitably, he'd lose his focus, turn his back, or look away for a second, and there would be a pile on. A few minutes later, his face cut up and swollen, he'd retreat across the street to the Kmart, followed by the rest of the Amish teenagers. And the next week, to everyone's surprise, he'd be back again. Not even bitter about it, but just sitting there at the edge of the booth, waiting. It wasn't until late April that Tanner and I started dating the girls, but like I said, it wasn't really dating. They were all extremely shy, and there wasn't a whole lot of common ground. Mostly, we would ask them questions about their lives, and they would nod or shake their heads and giggle. And then we would sit and watch as they nervously stuffed their faces with cheeseburgers. Later, we would walk them back across the street to Kmart, and then sometimes, if no one else was around, they would kiss us in the shadows. And then, almost like it never happened, they'd be gone again, and we'd have to wait a whole week. Sometimes they'd never come back, and we wouldn't know why. We couldn't exactly call them up. Usually, we didn't even know their names. So if they didn't show up the next week, we'd try to meet two new ones. Well, back at our school, pretty girls wouldn't talk to us. We were unexceptional. Failures at sports, and our fathers didn't manage banks or practice orthopedic medicine. And out on the rural highway, we dated the most beautiful of the Amish girls. They were attracted to our foreignness, and we to theirs. At school, there were jokes about us, naturally, mainly inbreeding jokes. Someone had heard that our girlfriends had two heads, three nostrils, tails coming out of their backbones. It was almost summer, and so we tried to ignore it, ride it out, though it made us think about what we were doing. And it was not right, what we were doing. We were aware of that. And in a way, we were still scared of the Amish, even the girls. There was something unnatural about them. It's hard to explain. They would only let you so close. And it was always in private, where no one could see. Sometimes they would kiss you and then run away. Or else you would be thinking about making a move, not even doing anything, and they would just start to cry for no reason, like they knew. I wonder now if it was not worse to let them leave the farms only once a week, if giving them only a small taste of freedom did not make the temptation stronger. Perhaps that's why so many never came back. It was simply too hard. Tanner came from country people. Though he'd grown up in town like me, it didn't seem to make a difference. The wealthy kids still called him a hick and made fun of the way he talked and dressed. And you did not want to have the stigma of being from the country in our high school. Tanner and I both lived on the edge of the wealthy area, just across the street from it, really. We were in the seventh grade when the school zone switched, and the school district agreed to let us finish out our education at Cedar Crest High, where all the beautiful and wealthy kids went, the only decent school in the county. I had grown up with them, the wealthy kids, and even sometimes felt aligned with them when I'd see some of the dirty and disreputable country kids raising hell at our dances. But among them, sitting in class or walking in the hall, I was aware of our differences. Up until the ninth grade, I had lied about my father's occupation, told people that he did a lot of work overseas, that his job was sort of secretive, and I was not at liberty to discuss it. College wrestling coach didn't sound that great next to heart surgeon or judge. But I don't think anyone believed me anyway. They knew where I lived and knew that I was not a member of the country club and that I was friends with Tanner. We were not one of them, Tanner and I, though we were not as low as country people either. There was one girl I saw consistently that summer. Her name was Rachel. She wasn't shy or afraid of the outside world, and her hair smelled like tall field grass, a sweet smell. And she was beautiful, too. She did not look like the other Amish girls. She lacked the full-bodied German figure, the solid thighs, the broad shoulders, the round, doughy face. She was thin, small-framed, and with different clothes could have easily passed for one of the popular girls at Cedar Crest. She was curious, too. Some nights she would want to leave the diner and ride around in Tanner's truck. She would beg Tanner and me to take her into town, or else she would want to drive out to the Leisure Lane's bowling alley and shoot pool and smoke cigarettes. She was always excited, anxious, wanting to do and see as much as possible in the few hours she had. When we were alone, Rachel wanted to know everything about me. She wanted to know what my school was like, what my house was like, what it was like to go to Ocean City. She wanted it all described to her in detail, almost like she was saving it up, collecting it. Only once, when we were parked outside the diner, did she tell me about her family. It was an enormous family, she said. More than 20 of them lived in one house. Her father was 70 years old, the patriarch of the entire household, and he had set up rules and standards based on the very first order of Amish, now 300 years old. These were standards that she was expected to uphold and pass down to her children. She had an obligation, she said, being one of the chosen very, very few. But she seemed upset as she told me these things. I could tell it made her feel guilty to think about her family, especially when we were together. And after that one night, we never talked about it again. All summer, the heat was getting worse. It had not rained for a record 6 weeks. Out in the deep country, the crops were drying up, and in town, the grass on people's lawns, even the wealthy ones, were turning into a yellow thatch. There was no escaping it. Even at night, the air was thick with humidity and stuck to your skin like wet towels. One thing Rachel liked to do was to go down to the river valley, where there was an old railroad track that had been out of service for more than 50 years. In all that time, no one had ever thought to dig down the tracks. They were rusted now, covered with weeds, and you could follow them for a mile or so to where they crossed over the river on an old wooden bridge, more than 30 feet high. Rachel liked to have barefooted races across the planks of the bridge. The planks were evenly spaced, about 2 feet apart from each other. With a full moon, it was easy. You could see where you were stepping. But other nights, it would be pitch black, and you would have to do it blind. It came down to faith, that and timing. If you slipped once, if your timing was slightly off, your foot would slide into an empty space and you might snap a shin bone. Or worse, if you were unfortunate and slipped through, you might fall 30 feet into the water. And of course, we were young and confident, and so we never once slipped or fell or even stumbled. The trick was always to get a rhythm in your head and to concentrate on it. But like I said, it mainly came down to faith, an almost blind trust that the wooden plank would be right there when you put your foot down. And it always was. Tanner would sometimes come along with a girl he had met that night, and we would all take a blanket and some iced tea down by the river and sit out underneath the stars. Some nights it was so hot, Tanner and I would take all our clothes off and jump in the water, and the girls would watch us and giggle, never once thinking to join us, and we, of course, never asked. We knew the limits. We knew how far to push things, and the truth was, we never wanted to push, being inexperienced in those matters ourselves, and also not wanting to ruin what we had. We were young, and somehow sex seemed intricately entwined with those other things, responsibility and growing up, and we were not interested in any of that. By then, We'd stopped hanging out at the diner altogether. It was no longer exciting to watch the fights, and Rachel said it depressed her. More and more people had started coming out to watch, and he was becoming somewhat of a local celebrity. Rachel told me one night that she knew him. She said his name was Isaac King, and that she'd gone to school with him up until the third grade when his parents pulled him out to work. She said that that past winter he had watched his brother die in an ice skating accident, and that everyone thought he'd gone a little crazy from it. He'd stopped going to church, she said, and it was only a matter of time before he left the community altogether. Some Fridays, we'd just drive, the three of us, with Rachel sitting between Tanner and me. Tanner liked to take his father's truck into the back country roads that were all dirt and race with the headlights off. It was terrifying and more fun than almost anything I've ever done. Coming around those narrow curves at a high speed, not knowing what to expect, sometimes not knowing even if we were on the road or not, and then flying a little, catching a little air when there was a bump or a small hill. Rachel loved it the most, I think. She'd close her eyes and laugh and sometimes even scream. She was not afraid to show her feelings like Tanner and me. And finally, when she was on the verge of tears, she would beg Tanner to stop. "No more!" she would scream. "Pull over!" And he would. By July, everything was changing quickly. Many of the Amish were already leaving, selling their farms to the contractors who'd harassed them for years. Rachel never talked about it much, though I know that it was on her mind. People she'd known her whole life were being driven off the land. Corporations even wealthier than the Amish themselves had moved in, offered sums of money that seemed impossible to refuse, and when that didn't work, had threatened them. Rachel was beginning to change, too. I knew she had strong feelings about leaving the Amish community by then, vanishing like the others had, though she never came out and said it to me, only hinted at it. For the first time, she'd begun to complain about the tediousness of her life. Once she'd even tried to leave, she said. She'd packed up a bag of clothes and food, but it stopped when she got to the highway near her farm, realizing she had no money and did not even know which direction led to town. With each Friday, our time together seemed to go quicker, and each time it got harder for her to go back home. I think now that she wanted me to do something. It was not unusual for Amish women to marry at 15 or 16, and I know that she was under a lot of pressure that summer to get married. Sometimes I tried to imagine what my parents would say if I brought her home with me, explained to them that she would be moving in. I imagined her coming to college with me and taking classes. I would get carried away sometimes, ignoring the absurdity of it, wanting to believe it could work. It was a good summer for Tanner and me, our best, I think, though we did very little until Friday nights. Days we stayed inside because of the heat and watched horror movies and drank iced tea by the gallon, and nights we drove around by ourselves in Tanner's truck planning what we'd do the next Friday. We were wasting time. Wasting our lives, our parents said, and it felt good. That next year would be our last in high school, and I think we were aware, even then, that we were nearing a pinnacle of sorts. The last summer, we would still be young enough to collect allowance and get away without working jobs. Our parents were never home that summer. There were cocktail parties and barbecues 5 or 6 times a week on our street, and it seemed that almost every night, the parents in the neighborhood got trashed. Never stumbling home before 1 or 2 in the morning. Sometimes Tanner and I would show up at a party just to steal beer. We would stick 10 or 12 cans into a duffel bag and then go back to my house and drink them on the back porch, sometimes end up falling asleep in the backyard by accident. In late July, we started driving the truck out into the deep country during the days. The roads were all dirt out there and illegal to drive on. Occasionally, we'd go out on a Saturday afternoon, hoping maybe to see Rachel or one of the girls Tanner had met the night before. It was different out there. Aside from the humidity and the bugs, it was somehow depressing to watch all the young Amish kids working in the fields in such heat, fully dressed in their black wool suits, struggling with their ancient and inefficient tools, horse-drawn plows, steel-wheeled wagons. It seemed cruel. One Friday night, I borrowed Tanner's truck and took Rachel to the other side of town to see my house. We parked outside, just looking at it, not talking. That night, my parents were having a party, and inside, we could hear people laughing and the record player going. I could imagine my father, slumped in his big leather recliner, surrounded by a circle of drunk guests telling stories, and my mother carrying around trays of pierced olives and glasses of cold gin. Later on, I knew my father would step outside and begin wrestling people, and everyone would go yelling, "Go, coach! Pin him!" My father had been a wrestling star in college, and whenever he drank, he'd start challenging his guests. The thought of my father rolling around on the lawn with another grown man depressed me, and I suddenly wanted to go back to the diner. But Rachel seemed happy listening to the music and laughter from inside. After a few minutes, she said, "Let's go inside." I looked at her then and suddenly thought what my father would do if I brought my Amish girlfriend into his house while he was throwing a party. My father, like most, did not like the Amish. "Let's go," she said. "I want to try a beer." I told her that it would be easier if I went inside and snuck the beer out to the truck myself. A few minutes later, I emerged with a couple of six-packs, and we drove down to the river and drank all 12 beers. Afterwards, we lay down in a patch of grass near the water and acted silly. We felt loose, and we were affectionate with each other. It was Rachel's first time being drunk, and she was being funny about it, kissing me in strange places, my elbow, my eyelid, my pinky. Then at one point, I can't remember exactly, I started to understand that she was trying to tell me something, that it was okay. We could. That is, she would if I wanted to. She was gripping my body tightly then, and it surprised me, and it scared me too, because it did not feel tender anymore, but angry almost. And I know now that whatever she was trying to do, whatever she wanted that night, did not have anything to do with me. And even though we never did, she still cried for a long time that night, and I held her. And later, when I drove her back to the diner and we said goodnight, I was afraid that I would never see her again. In late August, Tanner and I drove out into the deep country for the last time. Rachel had not showed up to the diner for 2 weeks, and I had hopes of seeing her. I needed to talk to her. And Tanner, my best friend, drove me around all day. We never did see her, though we did see Isaac King as we were driving out toward the highway. It surprised us to see him, and we stopped for a while and watched him working in the field. He was the equivalent of a foreman, in charge of the younger boys, probably his brothers and cousins. It was strange to watch him at work. He was a different person out in the fields, not quiet like he was at the diner, but loud, animated. He moved around the field swiftly, like an animal, and the young boys listened to him and even seemed a little scared of him. We parked up on a hill out of sight. We were still scared of him ourselves, even from a distance. I can tell you now that I did not really hate him. But those nights I'd watched him take on 4 or 5 kids at once, I believed that I hated him. I hated him for never acknowledging the futility of the situation, for not bowing his head like the others and going home, for not accepting his place like the rest of us, like my parents did, like Tanner did, and like I did. He must have spotted us before because he came up slowly from behind the truck and surprised us. He might have thought we were two of the kids from the diner who beat him up every week, looking for some more action. But if he did, he didn't say anything. It was illegal for us to be on that land, even illegal to be driving a car on those back roads. But he never asked us to leave. He just stared at us until he realized that we were not there to fight him. And then he turned around and went back to the field. Rachel finally showed up at the diner the last Friday in August. She was shy with me and distant. She told me that a lot of families in the community, including hers, were moving to Indiana at the end of November after the harvest. The town was growing quickly, she said. It was just a matter of time before they would be forced to leave. She looked at me very solemnly as she said this. "So, what does that mean?" I said. "You're leaving for good?" She nodded. "I think so." I took her hand. "That's terrible," I said. "I know," she said. "I know." I've sometimes wondered what would have happened had I asked her that night to leave her community, to marry me and come live with me and my family. I thought of asking her even then, that night, but it would have been a cruel thing to suggest. My parents would have never agreed. It was an absurd thought when you got right down to it. I was a pretty good student, after all, college bound. Rachel had been begging me to take her to a movie all summer. She'd never seen one before. So instead of spending our last night talking as we usually did, I took her to a rerun of an old Boris Karloff film playing at a place called the Skinny Mini. After the movie, we drove around for a long time, just talking, though neither of us ever brought up that last night we'd been together. I'm certain now that she'd been thinking about something else as she watched the movie, and then later as we drove around. And somehow I could tell, even before she said the words, that she wasn't going to miss it. We drove through town without talking. Rachel seemed disinterested, not even looking out the window, and the town seemed sad now, in the way every town looks at the end of summer. It seemed cold already and empty, as if all the possibility Rachel had seen in it that summer had disappeared, and now it contained only the same dismal potential it had every year. It's strange, but I was not angry at her for leaving like this. I could tell she was not happy about it. And as we drove back to the diner, I suddenly wanted to tell her how much I'd enjoyed the time that we'd spent together, how much it had meant to me. I wanted to assure her that I would not forget her. But I never did. When we got back to the diner, there was a crowd in the back lot, as usual. We walked over and saw Tanner watching. He was alone. 10 minutes, he said. Unbelievable. Isaac King had been up for 10 minutes. It was a record. Kids were gathered around the circle shouting, some of them jockeying for position. I moved in closer to the group and found a spot near the edge. I could see that Isaac King was still up on his feet, his arms flailing. What I never understood was why he never gave up. It shows that he was not right. Because even if he had been able to do the impossible, defeat 5 at once, there would be 5 more waiting on the sidelines, and then 5 more after that, and so on. But that night, It was clear something was different. He wasn't going to let himself go down. In fact, he lasted a record 20 minutes. In the end, it took 6 or 7 guys to finally get him off his feet, and even after he'd been pinned down on his back, he was still trying to move his arms and his legs. Someone finally used a 2x4 to knock him out. It was an unnecessarily hard blow, and even today, I do not know which of the kids delivered it. His head split open near the hairline, and when the blood started, everyone scattered. I walked over to Tanner. "Hey," I said, "what the f*** just happened?" "I don't know," he said. "I have no f***ing idea." It took a half hour to get him across the street and into a buggy. He was losing a lot of blood by then and had passed out. I suggested calling an ambulance, but Rachel said they never used the hospital. I tried to insist, but she was stubborn about it. "No," she said. "They wouldn't like it." "Who's they?" I said. But she turned away. I never got a chance to say goodbye to her. When she left, she was crying, though I knew it was not because she would never see me again. Tanner and I went home after that and never went back to that part of town or talked about that night again. Instead, we went into our senior year of high school and took the SATs and then off to college, like everyone else. I never saw Rachel again, but a few months later, I found out from Tanner that Isaac King had died of a brain clot 6 weeks after that night. It was a small article in the paper, and no allegations were made. These days, almost all the Amish have left. Most have sold off their land cheap to real estate agencies and contractors and gone west to Indiana and Iowa. We have new malls and outlet stores where their farms were. And out where Rachel used to live, actors dressed in Amish costumes and fake beards stand along the thruway, chewing on corncob pipes and beckoning carloads of tourists to have their pictures taken with them. I am 29 years old now and not married. I'm not yet old, but some days I am aware of it closing in on me. Tanner lives in California now with a woman that will one day be his wife, but I can remember when he still lived here in Leola, only a few blocks away. When I think about Rachel now, I think mostly about those races we used to have out across the railroad bridge, 30 feet above the water, and I still shudder at our carelessness. Our blind motions, not watching where we were stepping, not even considering what was below us.
Chris Lewin reading Departure by Andrew Porter, who spoke to me from his base in San Antonio about this story. Andrew, tell us about the genesis of the story Departure. How did you learn about the world of Amish teenagers?
Well, I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which has a very large Amish community. It's actually the town where the film Witness was made back in the 80s. So I grew up among the Amish, and when I was a teenager, there was a strip mall near where I lived where I used to go with my friends to play video games after school, and I remember at a certain point we began noticing a group of Amish teenagers who would show up about once a week, sort of dressed in regular street clothes, and they would hang out and play video games and in some ways try to assimilate. And I think at the time I didn't really understand what was going on. It was only later that I realized that this was kind of something that had been set up by their parents as a way of giving them a chance to be exposed to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know this is a thing you're never supposed to ask an author, but did any of what's in the published story actually happen to you?
No, I never dated an Amish girl when I was a teenager. That was completely fictional.
One thing that interested me in the story, among many, is that the Amish are seen as underdogs, but also a lot of the surrounding residents see them as threats.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were always kind of a mysterious presence, at least for me. And I think, you know, most people had a pretty good relationship with the Amish, but there are always those groups of people who resented them or were suspicious of them in some way because they were outsiders. And so, you know, that was something I was exploring in the story.
But what interested me so much was that the hero of the story, or the narrating storyteller and his friend Tanner, are themselves outsiders when it comes to the reigning country club set of snotty rich kids. Does that perhaps lead them to their interest in this other group of outsiders, the Amish?
Exactly. I mean, I think that's why the narrator feels such a strong connection with them. I think he's intrigued initially because he sees some similarity between them and himself and Tanner.
Andrew, tell us, if you will, about this book that includes the story departure, your book, The Theory of Light and Matter.
It's my first book, and the stories tend to focus primarily on American suburbia. And like The Story Departure, they often involve characters or groups of people you might not normally see in suburbia.
Andrew, thanks so much for doing this.
It's been a pleasure for me as well.
That was the author, Andrew Porter. After a short break, we'll hear a classic noir tale by William Cole. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our final story on this program, William Cole's Waiting for Rusty, is a vintage histoire noir piece, first published in Black Mask magazine in 1939. The characters waiting for Rusty, their leader, after a bank heist, include Rusty's moll, Dottie, who really is a gun moll because she has a gun that figures prominently in this surprising tale of crime, loyalty, and betrayal. Our reader is Ted Marcoux.
One of these days, I'm going to tell the sheriff. One of these days, he's going to blow his mouth off once too often, and I'm going to take him out there and show him. I may get on his wrong side, but it'll be worth it. I'm just closing up my little roadside place for the night when they come in, Dottie and three guys. One of the men has a sawed-off shotgun, and he stands by the window. Dottie and the others come up to the bar. "Evening, Professor," Dottie says, looking around. "You here alone?" "Yeah," I says, when I'm able to talk. "Yeah, but good," Dottie says. "Lock that back door and then start pouring rye." She's wearing a blue slicker turned up at the neck and no hat. Her light hair is a little fluffed from the wind. She looks about the same as I remember she did when she went to the high school at Millbrook, only now you can't look long at her eyes. "Listen, miss," I says, "listen, you don't want to stay here long. They're surrounding the whole county. I just got it over the radio." "He's right," the man at the window says. "We got to keep moving, Dot. We got to keep moving and fast, or we'll wake up in the morgue." "Get outside," Dottie tells him, "and keep your eyes open or you'll wake up there anyway." She goes over and turns on the radio. The other two men keep walking around. They're all smoking cigarettes, one right after the other. I know enough to do what I'm told. There's nothing on the radio but some dance music. The two men look at each other. Then the shorter one goes over to Dottie. I know how you feel, Dot, he says, but they're right on our tail. We gotta... I told you boys once, Dot, he says, and I'm not telling you again. We wait here for Rusty. But supposing he don't come, says the man. He has a way of rubbing his wrist. Supposing he can't make it. Supposing you dry up, Dottie says. Rusty said he'll be here, and when Rusty says something, the music breaks off and she whirls to listen to the press radio flash. It's about the same as the last. The police have thrown a dragnet around the entire northern part of the state and are confident of capturing Rusty Nelson and his mob at any hour. Dottie don't think much of this, but when she's called Rusty's girl or gun mall number one, she smiles and takes a bow. After the bank holdup yesterday, the announcer says, Rusty and Dottie split up, one car going north, the other northwest. The state trooper who tried to stop Dottie at Preston this afternoon died on the way to the hospital. Too bad, Dottie says. He had the nicest blue eyes. A car goes by on the highway outside, and they all stand still for a second. Then the music comes back loud, and the men jump to tune it down low. The taller one is swearing under his breath. Canada ain't big enough, he says, sarcastic, like, we gotta meet here. Dottie don't say anything. In no time at all, they finish the bottle of rye. I open another. Maybe he couldn't get through, the shorter man says. Maybe he tried to, but couldn't. There's another radio flash. The cops have traced Rusty to Gatesville. This makes Dottie feel a lot better. She laughs. He's near Gatesville, she says, like we're near Siberia. She gets feeling pretty good, thinking of Rusty. She don't mind the music now the way the men do. She asks me if it comes from the pavilion, and I tell her yes. I was there once, she says. I went there with Rusty. They were having a dance, and he took me. The men aren't interested, and she tells it to me. I had to wear an old dress because that's all I had, but Rusty, he sees me and says, gee, kid, where'd you get the new dress? And we hop in his boiler and roll down there. She has stopped walking around now, and her eyes are all different. They have the whole place fixed up. Those colored lights on a string and the tables under the trees and the two bands on the platform. As soon as one stops, the other one starts. And there's this guy goes around in a white coat with these little sandwiches, and you can take all you want. There's the scream of a siren in the distance. The men take out guns. The girls all wear flowers, Dottie says, and I don't have none. But Rusty says, you just wait here, and soon he's back with a big bunch of flowers, all colors and kinds, only I can't wear half of them. There's too many. And then we dance and drink punch until the cops come. And then we have to lam it out of there. They say Rusty bust in the glass in the town florist shop. The siren is much louder now. The man with the shotgun runs in. A patrol car just passed, he says. Come on, let's blow. Dottie don't seem to hear. Get back out there, she tells him. The man's face goes even whiter. He looks at Dottie and then at the others. I say we move, he says. Rusty or no Rusty, we'll be knocked off here, sure. The other men try to stop him, but can't. And we don't even know that he'll show. He might have turned south or kept west. All the time we're waiting here, he might even be... Dottie has put her back to the bar. She waves a gun at the man. Get away from that door, she says. She leans back on her elbows. Drop that rattle and get over there. We don't want to have to step over you. It takes the man a minute to get it. Then his knees begin to give. He He opens his mouth a few times, but nothing comes out. Then there's that static on the radio and the announcer telling how Rusty was nabbed in Talbot. Dottie stands there and listens, resting back on the bar. Not a single shot was fired, the announcer says. The gangster was completely surprised by the raid. Alone in the hideout with Nelson was a pretty dark-haired, unidentified girl. Then there's that static and the music again. Nobody looks at Dottie for a while. Then the man with the shotgun bolts for the door. No sooner he's opened it, he's shut it again. There's a guy coming up the road, he says. He's got on a badge. For what seems a long time, Dottie don't move. Then she reaches out and snaps off the radio. Let him come, she says. You guys get out in the car. The men don't argue. They go out the back. Dottie walks slowly to the door. When she speaks, her voice isn't flat anymore. You know, she tells me, it was funny about those flowers. They just wouldn't stay put. Every minute I'd fix them, and the next minute they'd slip. One of the girls said the pin was too big. She steps out on the porch, and I drop flat in the back of the bar. Hello, copper, I hear her say. The rest is all noise. One of these days, I'm going to show the sheriff. One of these days, he's going to tell once too often how he got Dottie, and I'm going to take him out onto the porch and show him. Sure, she might have missed him. Even Dottie might have missed him twice in a row. But she would never have put those two slugs in the ceiling. Not Dottie. Not unless she had reason to. Not unless she wanted to die.
Waiting for Rusty by William Cole, read for us by Ted Marcoux. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. We wanted to let you know about two opportunities to become more involved with our series. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience, nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders. And second, if you've always wanted to try your hand at writing a short story of your own, Enter the 2010 Selected Shorts Stella Kupferberg Memorial Writing Contest, judged by fiction writer Nathan Englander. The winner will receive a $1,000 prize, and the winning story will be featured on Selected Shorts. Enter at selectedshorts.org.